I remember Annabella saying to me that she had done this crazy thing with Harvey, Paul Felcher told a New York City jury. Felcher described himself as a longtime friend of actress Annabella Sciorra. He said they had met on a movie set in the 1990s. And do you remember where you were when she said that to you? Lead defense attorney Donna Rotuno asked him. No, we were on an extremely long walk that night from Lincoln Center to, I believe we ended up going to a restaurant in Alphabet City, which is, if you know New York City, that's about an hour and a half, 2 hour walk. Felcher was describing a night in the 1990s, but he couldn't remember the exact year. At the time, what was your understanding of what she meant when she was talking about something crazy? My understanding, as I understand it all these years later, was that there were no components about what she was saying I found shocking or alarming, or it was not, I don't recall it being stressful. My understanding was that she fooled around with him. He said he would be a horrible friend if he had found it shocking or alarming and hadn't followed up. But he doesn't remember having any more conversations about the incident. Days earlier, Annabella Sciorra had described for the same jury an incident with Weinstein that, to her, she said was both shocking and alarming. She accused Weinstein of forcibly raping her inside her apartment. This witness on the stand seemed to contradict that description. Defense attorney Donna Rotuno continued on with her questioning of Felcher. And did Ms. Annabella Sciorra ever say anything to you about Harvey forcing her to do anything? No. Were there events that both Ms. Sciorra and Harvey were both present? I believe so. And did she ever say to you that she did not want to be near him? No. When you saw Ms. Sciorra, Ms. Sciorra's account after speaking to Ronan Farrow, were you surprised? Prosecutor Eluzzi objected to this question. Judge Burke sustained the objection. How did you feel after seeing Ronan Farrow's book? Another objection, and Judge Burke again sustained it. Did you ever know Ms. Sciorra to be friends with Rosie Perez? Objection. This time, it was overruled. Felcher told the court that he does remember Sciorra mentioning Rosie Perez. And he said he knew Sciorra to drink alcohol and take prescription medication. He explained that in 2016, he was hired to be a consulting producer on a film called The Upside, which was weeks away from going into production by the Weinstein Company. My function was meant to be the Grim Reaper, who went in to try to slash the budget weeks before the beginning of the print of photographs. He said he was meant to be paid $60,000 over 6 weeks, but he had to hire a lawyer in order to receive his salary. The defense proceeded to show him emails between him and the Weinstein Company. The prosecution objected, claiming they had never seen these emails, and that Felcher was paid from Weinstein's personal account, not the company's. Judge Burke allowed the emails to be admitted into evidence. One line of the email read, "I am loyal to you, Harvey. I will always have your back. You call on me. Honoring our agreement helps me know you've got mine." Felcher explained what he meant by that. "Briefly, my relationship with the company is that I was sent into a lot of very difficult situations, films that were in trouble, etc. So I was kind of a Miramax Weinstein Company Red Adair. And I felt like I always did a really good job for Harvey. I was pissed off that I wasn't being paid as promised." And did that conversation or this payment on the movie, The Upside, have anything to do with your testimony in court here? Zero. Felcher was the first witness called by Harvey Weinstein's defense. In parts 1 and 2, I covered the prosecution's case and recounted the testimony of 6 women who accused Weinstein of sexually assaulting them. He was only criminally charged for incidents alleged to have occurred with 2 of them, Mimi Halley and Jessica Mann. Prosecutors then obtained an amended indictment which would enable Weinstein to be facing life in prison for predatory sexual assault if the jury believed the testimony of another accuser, Annabella Sciorra. And so his defense sought to discredit Sciorra, along with the other five women, in their case in chief. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 103, Part 3, the final episode in the trial of New York versus Harvey Weinstein. On cross-examination, Paul Felcher told the jury that he was there after being subpoenaed by the defense. He said many months ago, someone from the prosecution's office called, asking if he would want to speak to them about the Harvey Weinstein case. He said he told them he did not. "Have you been speaking to the defendant about coming here and testifying?" Prosecutor Aluzzi asked. "I have talked to Harvey. Harvey's my friend. I have been talking to him for a long time, yeah," Felcher answered. He said he's known Weinstein for about 30 years, but their relationship wasn't friendly in the beginning. He's known Annabella Sciorra for about the same amount of time, although he said he hasn't seen her in about 7 years. He said he also hadn't seen Weinstein for a long time until they reconnected 4 years ago. "I got reconnected with Harvey Weinstein, which felt sort of very fortuitous to me, right after the 2016 election, which was personally really difficult for me. And Harvey was always, in my experience, on the right, as I perceived it, on the right side of politics, and I was happy to be back in his orbit." Felcher said the head of production at Miramax called him, saying Weinstein wanted him to take over production on a new job. They were in regular contact until he had an issue with getting paid the $60,000 for the consulting job. Felcher said he reached out to Weinstein in October 2017, when all this happened. Since then, they've been in constant contact. The two speak nearly every week, sometimes more, sometimes less. "This is somebody I knew that was in trouble, and I was speaking to him partially because nobody else was. So I was talking to him." "You felt badly for him?" "I felt badly that he was completely abandoned. I felt badly that it was looking very difficult for him to be the recipient of due process. I don't really think of myself as Harvey's confidant. I was friendly to him. I'm not trying to distance myself from him. I'm just trying to give you an understanding of the nature of our friendship." Prosecutor Aluzzi asked him about the following text messages between him and Weinstein. "So November 1st of 2018, did you say to Harvey Weinstein that you believe there is likely a bunch of truth to the claims that he behaved like a cad and more?" "Yes." She asked if he also wrote, in another text message to Weinstein, that he knew Weinstein had an appetite and ambition for the things he wants. She asked him what he meant by that. "I meant that it was my understanding for a very long time that Harvey had a sex addiction and that he dated a lot of women." Then you go on to say, "If a lot of these girls had been my daughter, I would have wanted to beat the shit out of you. Is that right?" "That's correct." Felcher explained that he finds the thought of his 13-year-old daughter doing anything in that context to be abhorrent. "Look, I was trying to be a friend and to say, I know the extremes of your personality. I know the extremes of your appetite, but I did not believe that he was capable of the things that he had been charged with." Prosecutor Aluzzi wanted to clarify that he had, in fact, called Weinstein a sex addict. I did just say that, but I'm not a clinician. But I believe he had a voracious appetite that I spoke of. I think, yes, also applied to his appetite for women." Prosecutor Aluzzi next showed him a text message with Weinstein where they were talking about Annabella Sciorra. This took him aback. He said, "I'm learning a lot now, and I had no idea that my text messages would end up in a courtroom when I was texting him." In the text messages, Felcher said he thinks Annabella Sciorra is full of shit. Quote, "I know you guys had an awkward, whatever the fuck, night 20 years ago." He texted Weinstein that the rape version of the story got her an acting agent. And at one point, he called Sciorra an asshole. "Sir, is it correct to say that you were saying things that you thought Harvey Weinstein wanted to hear?" Yes. And that's what you're doing today, aren't you, sir? No. Aren't you, sir, saying things in this courtroom that you think Harvey Weinstein wants to hear? Categorically, no, he replied. Law and Crime's Jesse Weber was in the courtroom and noticed how some members of the jury were reacting to this testimony.
When Paul Felcher was being pressed about his relationship with Harvey Weinstein, one of the jurors looked up in the air and I believe shook his head at the, because it seemed to suggest that he wasn't answering the prosecutor's questions and was trying to defend himself, was trying to defend his relationship with Harvey Weinstein in a way. And look, this witness wanted to come off credible and he defended his text messages, but he was painted into a corner where it looked like that, as prosecutor Jonah Luzzi said, you're going to say whatever you have to say to help Harvey Weinstein. And at one point she said to him, you feel bad for him? You feel bad for him? And he seemed to indicate that he feels Harvey Weinstein is innocent, unless the jury feels otherwise, and that he is not getting due process. Now, that's one way to look at it. And I have to tell you that that's the right way to look at it from a legal point of view. But for a witness for the defense, I don't know if that's the way they thought this witness was going to go.
Outside the courtroom, reporters asked Weinstein if Paul Felcher was still his friend. Weinstein responded by saying, he did a great job. The defense also called an expert on memory to the stand. Dr. Loftus is a psychologist and distinguished professor. Her testimony was limited to talk about memory retention and memory in general. She was not allowed to get into specifics of this case or of sexual assault cases. Dr. Loftus testified that memory retention can be affected by post-event information. Factors that could be at play are suggestions that someone might hear, leading questions, media coverage, or therapy that could contaminate or taint one's memories of what actually happened. She said if someone is asked to remember something to satisfy a question or to help somebody, they might come up with false details. The defense was attempting to illustrate that the accuser's memories were not reliable. On cross, the prosecution asked Dr. Loftus about being biased. Prosecutor Aluzzi questioned her about her book, Witness for the Defense. She asked if she had ever written a book called Witness for the Prosecution, to which Dr. Loftus said no. Dr. Loftus agreed with the prosecution that when someone has a traumatic event, they may not remember every detail, but they will remember the core events.
There's a part of the reporters who seemed to be chuckling when Dr. Elizabeth Loftus was providing her testimony. And you could interpret that as if they don't find her credible. To quote Judge Burke, before the jury even came in, he said, you know, it's up to the jury to decide whether or not an expert is hocus pocus. Perhaps some of the reporters didn't really believe what she had to say. The jury paying very careful attention. They smirk at times. This seems to be a very attentive jury, but also the kind of jury that understands the main points of these witnesses immediately.
Next, the defense called a forensic document examiner. They were tasked with analyzing Mimi Halle's calendar and cross-offs she had made in it. The defense accused Halle of deliberately crossing off communications with Weinstein in her calendar, perhaps to hide information. Another witness for the defense was Nelson Lopez. Lopez said he currently works at 60 Gramercy Park and has worked there for 31 years. This is the apartment building where Annabella Sciorra used to live. He's now the residency manager and oversees the 7 doormen working at the building. He described that in order for a guest to be allowed inside, they must first see the doorman. The doorman will call the resident, and if the resident allows the guest in, they will be sent upstairs. If the resident doesn't answer or says the guest cannot come up, they are asked to leave. If that guest refuses, the doorman will call 911. He described a rigid security system with 24/7 doormen, 365 days a year. Doors lock at midnight, and they are never left unattended. If one of the doormen needs to use the restroom, there's protocol for that, he said. He testified that there's no directory of apartments listed outside. He noted the same procedures were in place in the 1990s, and he was able to list the first and last names of the doormen working then. He said Annabella Sciorra was a tenant who subleased an apartment for a year between 1993 and 1994. He said she never contacted security about someone trespassing on her floor, nor someone coming into her apartment unannounced. He told the court that he's seen Harvey Weinstein's picture in the media, but he's never seen him in the building. With his testimony, the defense was hoping to show that it was next to impossible for Weinstein to have gotten up to Shiora's apartment uninvited, as she had testified to on the witness stand. How could Weinstein have known which apartment she was in? Lopez said that for someone to come up to that apartment unannounced is almost impossible. Talita Maia is a Brazilian actress. She was Jessica Mann's friend and roommate in 2013. Her name was repeatedly mentioned during Mann's testimony, which I covered in part two. Talita Maia glanced at Weinstein and smiled as she took the witness stand. She described from her point of view when she and Mann met Weinstein at a party in early 2013. She said Weinstein first came up to her while she was sitting alone on a couch and joked that she was the only one eating at the Hollywood party. She said she thought it was hilarious because it was true. Then Mann walked up to them. "I realized I had to introduce them and I didn't know who he was. So he said, 'Harvey Weinstein.' I think he realized that we didn't know who he was, so he repeated himself, 'I'm Harvey Weinstein from the Weinstein Company.' I made a joke, 'That's why everyone is being so nice to you.' Mann put her arm around him and pinched his cheek and said, 'It's because he's so cute.' She said they later ran into Weinstein at Oscar parties and saw him at a dinner. She described Mann telling her about when she sang for Weinstein, saying that Mann told her a few times that he was her spiritual soulmate. She then recalled a night in February 2013 when she and Mann went up to Weinstein's Beverly Hills hotel suite. She said Mann and Weinstein told her that it won't take a long time and asked her to come with them. She said she was just uncomfortable, that she didn't want to go to a room with them. She said she sat and watched TV on the couch for about 10 minutes while Mann went into a room with Weinstein and they closed the door. 'Did they exit the room together?' Donna Rotunno asked her. 'As I recall, yes.' 'And how did your friend appear to you?' 'Normal.' 'Did she seem upset in any way?' 'No.' Maia said she then drove the two of them home. 'Did she seem okay in the car?' 'She seemed okay.' 'Did she seem happy?' 'She seemed okay. She seemed normal, like nothing was out of the ordinary.' She also recalled a time after that when she and Mann went to a movie screening and ran into Weinstein's wife at the time, Georgina Chapman. 'I think it was awkward for both of us. She was just in awe of Georgina. She's a very beautiful woman.' Rotunno asked, 'Did she ever have a conversation with you regarding Harvey, about her interactions with him, about being the best orgasm she has ever had?' Maia replied, 'She did volunteer that information at some point.'" On cross, prosecutor Megan Hast said their friendship had a very, very bitter falling out. "You very much dislike Jessica Mann right now, correct?" "I don't dislike Jessica. Jessica did things in my life that impacted my life in a very negative way. I wish I didn't have to go through that, but I don't hate her." Mann's friend Tommy Richards was also called to speak about the 2013 incident at the DoubleTree Hotel, which Mann had testified was when Weinstein raped her. He said he's a Los Angeles-based talent agent. He's now 47 and said he couldn't recall many of the specifics, but that he had breakfast with Mann and Weinstein at the hotel after that incident. Defense attorney Arthur Adala asked him, "Tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury how Jessica Mann appeared to you the last time you saw her that morning in New York." "Normal," he replied. Adala asked him to elaborate on what his definition of normal is. "Her everyday self." "Was there any indication to you whatsoever that Jessica Mann, that morning when you were having breakfast with her, was in any sort of distress?" "No." "Were her eyes swollen or puffy?" "No." Richard said Mann pulled him aside for a private conversation and asked if it was okay if she didn't go back to New York with him, because Weinstein asked her to stay an extra night. He said Mann appeared to be normal during that conversation as well. He testified that he was appearing in court due to a subpoena and that he isn't a friend of Weinstein's. On cross, Prosecutor Aluzzi asked if perhaps the only reason why Mann had asked him for permission was because she actually didn't want to stay with Weinstein and he had missed a cue from his friend. "Did you enjoy yourself by drinking a lot the night before?" she asked. "What do you mean by a lot?" Richards asked, while spectators in the courtroom laughed. The defense also called Claudia Salinas to the stand in an attempt to discredit accuser Lauren Young. Salinas denied Young's claim that she had led Young up to Weinstein's Beverly Hills hotel suite in 2013. She also said she hadn't closed the bathroom door. "If I had done that, I would have remembered. I would never do that. I would never close the door behind anyone." "I'm going to cut right to it," Weinstein's attorney, Damon Sharonis, said. "Did you ever see Harvey Weinstein coming out of a bathroom suite naked?" "No," Salinas said. "Ever see him naked under any circumstance?" "No, never." "Did you ever lock Lauren Young in a bathroom with Harvey Weinstein?" "No." During cross-examination, Prosecutor Megan Hast tried to undermine Salinas' credibility. Hast referred her to a police report in which she had told investigators that she didn't remember what had happened. "I just remember that we met," Salinas said. "I don't remember specifics. I remember we met for a drink. It could have happened, but it doesn't mean I was there." Hast also asked Salinas about her comments to investigators that, quote, "Harvey Weinstein was always asking me to bring my better-looking friends to events." Hast suggested through her questioning that Salinas brought friends along because she had rejected Weinstein. "And off of that, you started to bring your pretty, better-looking friends?" Hast asked. "All my friends are good-looking," Salinas replied, prompting laughs. Salinas appeared in three Miramax movies: 2004's Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights; 2008's Hell Ride; and 2009's Crossing Over. The judge asked Weinstein if he himself wanted to take the witness stand. Weinstein went into a witness room off to the side of the courtroom to have a conference with his attorneys. After about 15 minutes, they all returned. Attorney Damon Sharonis told the judge on behalf of Weinstein that he will not testify. Attorney Arthur Adala explained this decision after court.
"Mr. Weinstein has been a very good client, so we didn't have to restrain him, but he was ready, willing, and able, and anxious to testify, to clear his name, to clear the facts of these case. But Mr. Charonis and Ms. Rotuno, joined with the rest of the New York team, advised him that he did not need to do that because the evidence presented in this case was anemic at best. If his name was not Harvey Weinstein and it was John Doe, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office would have never brought these charges. The prosecutor has failed miserably to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. So he did testify on a couple of occasions when he stood before different judges and said, 'I am not guilty of all of the charges against him.'"
The defense reignited their motion to dismiss the charges, which Judge Burke denied. Then the prosecution told the judge they wanted to talk about Weinstein using a walker in their closing arguments, calling it a prop. Attorney Damon Sharonis jumped up and said, "It's not a prop." Both sides then argued back and forth. Judge Burke told the prosecutors not to mention it. Court then proceeded to closing arguments. The defense was the first to give their closing arguments. Donna Rotuno told the jury that Weinstein's fate now lies in their hands. She said she believes the district attorney's office failed to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt and implored them to have the courage to find him not guilty of all charges. Quote, "The irony is that the ADAs in this case are the producers, and they are writing the script in their story. They've created a universe that strips adult women of common sense, autonomy, and responsibility. In their universe, women are not responsible for the parties they attend, the men they flirt with, the choices they make to further their own careers, the hotel room invitations, the plane tickets they accept, the jobs they ask for help to obtain. In this script, a powerful man is the villain, and he is so unattractive and large that no woman would ever want to sleep with him voluntarily. Regret doesn't exist in this world. Rotunno reiterated some of her closing remarks outside of court, too.
The evidence shows consensual relationships. So if you claim that what you say happened, it belies common sense that you would then go out and send the emails, have the contact, continue relationships, send your phone numbers. So that's the reason that is consent. The evidence shows consent.
Rotunno then moved on to discredit the women who testified against Weinstein. If you don't believe Mimi Halley or Jessica Mann, you don't have to evaluate anyone else, she said. First, she went after Halley. This is a woman who says he barged his way into her apartment. She wanted him to leave. This is a woman who says, I could not go to Paris with him because I have no interest in him whatsoever. Then on July 10th, thinks absolutely nothing of going to his house. Either Miriam Halley did not want to be alone with Harvey Weinstein, and she would not put herself in such a position, or she did want to be alone with him, and she could not admit that fact. Rotunno then said accuser Jessica Mann's encounters with Weinstein were consensual as well. She was going to do anything she needed to do to have the career that she wanted to have. Whether she was attracted to him, whether she thinks he's gross or smells or all those horrible things she said when she testified, she made a choice that she wanted the life he could potentially provide for her. In the worlds they create, they want you to believe she didn't have a choice. She had her own room. She had her own key. She could have easily not gone back downstairs or gone up to her own room. Even if you believe every word she said, it does not rise to the level of a rape. Rotunno next attacked the four other bad act witnesses. She said testimony by actress Annabella Sciorra doesn't add up because Weinstein couldn't have gotten past her doorman, and that Sciorra had something to gain by coming forward 27 years later. She changed her memories and now she was raped. Once again, she's a star. She has a new agent. Now she's the darling of the movement. Rotunno said actress Rosie Perez was lying when she claimed Sciorra told her about the attack. Sciorra said she didn't even remember telling her. Quote, Rosie did what a friend does. She lied. At one point, Rotunno pointed to civil attorney Gloria Allred, who was sitting in the courtroom, and said, she doesn't sit here for her health. She sits here because she knows there's a pot of gold at the end of this criminal trial. Here's Rotunno, again, talking outside the courtroom.
Well, I had to focus on that because all of you focus on it every day. So it was something that I had to bring up. I had to bring it up. We feel good about where we are. This is a case that should be about evidence. It shouldn't be about emotion. It shouldn't be about feelings. And it's not a popularity contest. And in this case, the evidence was all on our side.
Rotunno concluded her closing arguments by talking about when the women came forward with their allegations in 2017. Quote, in October 2017, Harvey was no longer the famous Hollywood producer. He was no longer the king of Hollywood. He was the target of a cause and of a movement. This is not a game. This is not some rubber stamp media version of events or a kowtow to the court of public opinion. This is a criminal trial. And in a criminal trial, proof matters, evidence matters. It's a criminal trial where we don't judge on sympathy or emotion. She said justice demands the jurors find Weinstein not guilty. After court, Weinstein called Rotunno's closings the Queen's Speech, a play on words to one of his movies he had produced called The King's Speech. Outside the courtroom, Gloria Allred responded to Rotunno saying that the women were only after a pot of gold. She said she thinks the defense is desperate.
There has been no testimony whatsoever by Mimi that I was retained for the purpose of a civil lawsuit, that she has filed a lawsuit, which she hasn't, that she's going to, the fact that she might or could or would or may or who knows, means nothing. So it's an attempt to show bias that maybe somebody would want to be compensated for what they allege is a rape or sexual abuse. And by the way, if anybody does want to be compensated because they've been raped, sexually harassed, sexually abused, well, they should have every right to do so. The cost of the wrong should not be borne by the victim. The cost of the wrong should be borne by the wrongdoer.
Then it was the state's turn. Prosecutor Joan Aluzzi said Weinstein was a master of his universe, and the witnesses were merely ants he could step on without consequence. She said he stepped on, demoralized, humiliated, and ultimately abused and raped these women. But Weinstein underestimated them. He had what she called a surefire insurance policy, keeping tabs on the women to make sure that one day they wouldn't walk out of the shadows and call him exactly what he was, an abusive rapist. Weinstein was wrong, she said. Quote, the hallmark of a predator, isolate, isolate, isolate. When you're the only one and he is a giant, not only in his own industry, but he's somebody who gets presidents on the phone and he's talking to A-listers, people you will never meet in your entire life. You know what? You are really freaking hesitant to report and not just keep the peace. They didn't come for a beauty contest, didn't come for money, didn't come for fame. They came to be heard. They sacrificed their dignity, their privacy, and their peace for the prospect of having that voice, and their voices would be enough for justice. She asked the jury to find Weinstein guilty of all charges. Outside the presence of the jury, Prosecutor Aluzzi complained to Judge Burke that Donna Ratuno was speaking directly to the jury through her writing and called an op-ed Ratuno had written earlier for Newsweek magazine, Borderline Jury Tampering. The headline of the op-ed was, "Jurors in my client Harvey Weinstein's case must look past the headlines." Ratuno wrote, quote, "Jurors must accept the responsibility of not just considering the facts, testimony, and evidence, but cutting through the noise of a media and public intent on injecting their narratives into the courtroom." Ratuno responded and told the judge that she was commenting about criminal justice as a whole, not speaking to this particular jury. Attorney Damon Sharonis backed her up, saying the op-ed simply tracked what she said in closing. Judge Burke told Ratuno not to speak to the press until there's a verdict. Meanwhile, there was also another issue, a juror one. Juror number 11 had posted a review of a book during the course of the trial. The book was about an affair between a student and a much older teacher. In the review, juror 11 wrote about, quote, the repulsiveness of her predator and her entrapment in the relationship. Juror 11 herself had also written a book that is described in one review as, quote, a coming-of-age novel where one character struggles to resist the advances of a famous artist with whom she works. Of the other characters in the novel, quote, all three are affected by the sexual relationships with older men and the power adults hold over them, even as the young women begin to assert their independence. The defense asked for juror 11 to be replaced with an alternate juror who happened to be an older white man. Judge Burke brought in juror 11 for questioning. She first denied reviewing or reading any kinds of books, but then she admitted that she is currently reading a French book on the same subject matter. Judge Burke said she's reading the book, but that she did nothing wrong, and he denied the defense's motion for that juror to be replaced. He then denied a motion by the defense for a mistrial. Judge Burke then gave the jury their instructions and reviewed the charges. Count one was predatory sexual assault. This charge relates to Mimi Halle and Annabella Sciorra. Count two criminal sexual act in the first degree, relating to Mimi Halley. Count 3, predatory sexual assault, relating to Jessica Mann and Annabella Sciorra. Count 4, rape in the first degree, relating to Jessica Mann. And count 5, rape in the third degree, relating to Jessica Mann. Judge Burke instructed the jury to consider the 3 other bad act witnesses for the 2 issues of forcible compulsion and consent. Jury deliberations then began. After about 45 minutes, the jury handed in a note requesting written legal definitions, including that of forcible compulsion, consent, rape in the first and third degree, and criminal sexual act. They also sought further clarification of the conditions for how to find Weinstein guilty of some of the charges, but not all. They also requested a copy of the red flag list, the list Weinstein had allegedly made of the accusers he was concerned about and wanted Black Cube to investigate. The jury continued their deliberations for several more days. They would later request to have the testimony of Mimi Halley read back and for copies of emails between her and Weinstein. They requested a copy of the PowerPoint presentation by the state's expert psychiatrist, Dr. Ziv. The judge told them it was demonstrative and not in evidence, so they couldn't have it. But he did have Rosie Perez's testimony read back to them at their request. The jury later asked for testimony from Annabella Sciorra's cross-examination and redirect to be read back, but they signaled that they had heard all they needed before the cross-exam was finished. The defense requested Judge Burke to prevent attorney Gloria Allred from making statements to the media. They said Allred was accusing the defense of engaging in victim shaming. Outside court, Allred said she was speaking truth to the power of 5 defense attorneys in the courtroom. Judge Burke did not issue a protective order against Allred. In the hallway outside of the courtroom, there was a heated exchange. Allred told Rotuno that she was out of control and distorting the facts. On day 4 of deliberations, the jury submitted a note to the judge. Quote, "We, the jury, request to understand if we can be hung on 1 and or 3, but unanimous on the others. 1 and 3 being the predatory sexual assault charges attaching Annabella Sciorra to victims Mimi Halley and Jessica Mann." The prosecution rejected accepting a partial verdict. Judge Burke brought in the jurors and told them that they needed to try to continue their deliberations until they reach unanimous verdicts across the board. He then read them the deadlock charge. The jury went home for the weekend. After a total of about 26 hours of deliberations over 5 days, the jury announced they had reached their verdict. Count 1, predatory sexual act, not guilty. Count 2, criminal sexual act against Mimi Halley, guilty. Count 3, predatory sexual act, not guilty. Count 4, first degree rape, not guilty. And count 5, third degree rape of Jessica Mann, guilty. The counts he was guilty of collectively carried a minimum of 5 years and a maximum of 25 years. None of the accusers were in the courtroom for the verdicts. However, several of their attorneys were. It was a packed courtroom otherwise. Law and Crime's Jesse Weber described the scene when the verdict was read.
When the jury foreman stood up and delivered the verdict, he actually hesitated. You did see the jury members look at Harvey Weinstein as they were coming and exiting. The first count that he delivered on the verdict sheet, as you said, was predatory assault and ultimately found not guilty. There was no words, nothing, no sounds in the courtroom. But as soon as he went to the second count and delivered guilty, The defense table looked like they were hit with a truck. Harvey Weinstein looked stunned. There were gaffes in the courtroom. I mean, this was something that was many years in the making. When the verdicts were ultimately all handed out and the defense lost their bid to have their client on house arrest, Mr. Weinstein was remanded into custody. He was actually physically picked up by the court officers and removed from court. He was struggling. Absolutely surreal experience watching this. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. Surreal.
Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. reacted to the verdict in the courthouse hallway and said by no means was he disappointed with the verdict.
I think with regard to Jessica Mann, Harvey Weinstein was convicted for rape in the third degree. Ms. Shiora took great risk and was in substantial pain testifying about what happened to her many years ago. I can't look behind the jury's verdict or how they arrived at that. We have to respect that process. But by no means is it a statement against Ms. Shiora or against anything that she said in court. Jurors find a way through to a solution that they believe adequately brings them all together with a unanimous verdict. In terms of the cross-examination, I think we saw cross-examination, the kinds that we've seen for years and years and years. I hope that with this verdict, it will become more obvious that those kinds of attacks on the survivors and victims when they're on the stand, making it seem like it's all their fault, will be realized as legal attacks that just simply are no longer going to work in this day and age, and it's time that lawyers stop using them and continuing the myths that I think the jury verdict busted today.
Outside court, a chaotic scene in front of the press area. First, accuser Terrell Wolf's attorney, Douglas Wigdor.
One of the things about today is we will not see Harvey Weinstein come down those steps in his feeble attempt of pretending to be unwell and using a walker, because he is now in custody. He's been remanded. He awaits sentencing in March by Judge Burke. And today is a significant day because he's been held responsible for his actions. But while we can't undo that harm, while he's been convicted, we can't undo the harm that he has caused to so many victims. Today will be some mode of relief for all of the assault survivors who hopefully today can bring about some sense of relief.
Then attorney Gloria Allred went to speak to the press. But as she approached the microphone, the defense team also went to speak to the media.
So you guys are going to have to make a choice because we have to go do some work. So you can either hear from the defense team or you can hear from
You're
Gloria.
You're not going
you
to silence me again.
No silencing you.
Oh, yes,
no
you are.
All right,
oh,
so
yes,
then you guys
you
aren't going to hear from us.
Well, really?
Donna!
The defense walked away. Allred, however, called the verdict a vindication for women.
All of my three clients should be considered heroes of the women's movement and the victims' rights movement. These witnesses told their truth under oath, despite what many people felt were unfair attacks on their credibility by Harvey Weinstein's defense lawyers.
But the defense gave their own statement to the press, off to the side.
We knew we came in and we were down 35-0 the day that we started this trial. The jurors came in knowing everything that they could know about this case. We couldn't find a juror that ever heard of Harvey Weinstein. You know, there's an appellate process. It will absolutely be appealing. The fight is not over. No, Harvey is strong, as I said. Obviously, he's disappointed, but he's strong. He's mentally tough, and he's going to continue to fight. I thank all of you for starting to become more fair as time went on, and I think that once everybody looked at the evidence, I think it's fairly clear that we were on the right side.
Weinstein told the court he was experiencing heart palpitations and was hospitalized. His spokesperson said he had surgery, and doctors put a stent into his heart. About a week later, he was transferred to Rikers Island. Actress Rosanna Arquette accused Weinstein of assaulting her in the early 1990s. She was one of the first silence breakers to come forward. She's best known for her role in Pulp Fiction and said Weinstein sought to harm her acting career.
Now we know
that if we dare to speak, there is a far greater chance we will be heard and our abusers will be punished. This seismic cultural change that began 2.5 years ago has been brought to a legal conclusion, to justice. Think about that. I want you to take this in. It is a historic shift that I never thought I would see in my lifetime. We're here to hold space for all women and children and men, for the brave women who have testified at this trial, who went through their own personal hell to bring us to this moment of justice.
Actress Catherine Kendall said Weinstein also assaulted her in 1993.
I am one of the many women that was targeted by Harvey Weinstein and the agency that he hired, the Black Cube. And every day that went by that he was not in jail, I feared that I would once again be targeted. It's so important that women continue to come forward and break their silence so that predators like Harvey can be put away. Harvey banked on our fear. He bet on our silence, and he collected for many, many years. But today, he lost the bet, and we're the ones winning.
Investigative producer Rich McHugh worked with Ronan Farrow at NBC News. He talked about when NBC decided to kill their story on Weinstein in 2017.
We've learned that very early on, Weinstein was aware of the fact that we were trying to report this. And we know soon after the Rose McGowan interview in February of 2017, he was aware of us and he had employed Black Cube to look into Rose. But when we met with Rose and did the interview, I think he was aware of us. And so daily emails would go from Black Cube associates to Harvey saying, this is what McHugh and Farrell are working on, et cetera. And NBC executives confirmed to his lawyer in the middle of the summer, we were no longer working on a story on Harvey Weinstein. These women, to a T, none of them wanted to be in this situation. And they've gone through incredible trauma in the years, in the decades following. And so for him to say these were specious claims or whatever, it speaks to a guy who's been able to operate with impunity for decades and hasn't really had to be accountable to anything. And I think we're just seeing the levels of concentric circles that protected this guy for decades. And I think that's potentially the next focus.
In an 11-page memo, prosecutors asked the judge to consider decades of allegations when sentencing Weinstein. The oldest allegation was from 1978, a woman who said she had worked for Weinstein's music company in Buffalo, New York, was forced to share a hotel room with him. When she awoke, Weinstein was forcing himself sexually on her. There were more than 30 people who had listed their own complaints, but that were not able to be entered into this case. Weinstein's defense asked for a 5-year sentence, citing his charity work and family life. The day before Weinstein was scheduled to be sentenced, about 1,000 pages worth of court documents were unsealed. In them, an inside look into Weinstein's mind as allegations were surfacing and his world was unraveling in 2017. He sent emails to prominent people begging for help, including former New York City mayor and former Democratic presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, and Apple executive Tim Cook. In another email, a reporter asked him about possible allegations by actress Jennifer Aniston. He later wrote to his representative, quote, "Jen Aniston should be killed." Another email of note was from Weinstein's brother and former co-chairman of the Weinstein Company, who wrote, "I pray there is a real hell. That's where you belong." Finally, it was sentencing day. The 6 women who testified against Weinstein entered the courtroom. Jessica Mann, Mimi Halle, Dawn Dunning, Terrilee Wolfe, Lauren Young, and Annabella Sciorra, who walked side by side with Rosie Perez. Mann and Halle both gave victim impact statements. They both asked the judge to hold Weinstein accountable for his actions. And then Harvey Weinstein spoke.
We heard from the man himself, Harvey Weinstein. Speaking in a low, gravelly voice, he expressed remorse for what he did, explained that he is working on becoming a better person, regretted not spending more time with his children, who he said mean everything to him, and that he is learning a lot. However, he also said that he was confused and thought he had legitimate relationships with these women. Weinstein warned about the lack of due process and warned that this situation is similar to the communist purge. Although explaining he would have done things differently, he seemed to justify his tough attitude at work. Finally, he spent a large portion of his statement focusing on his efforts to help people and his charitable contributions.
Judge Burke told Weinstein, although this is a first conviction, it is not a first offense. He then handed down his sentence, 20 years for rape in the first degree against Jessica Mann and 3 years for criminal sexual act against Mimi Halle. The charges are to run consecutively, so Weinstein must serve 23 years in prison. If he is released, he must then register as a sex offender. Outside court, Gloria Allred held up a sign saying, "This is what justice looks like, 20 plus 3 years. Actress Ambra Gutierrez, another accuser, said the number 23 had an especially important meaning to her. She recorded Weinstein admitting to groping her in a sting operation by the NYPD in 2015, but the Manhattan DA's office declined to prosecute him for the incident.
I could say that I was 23 years old when he ruined my life, so I guess he's the number they deserve at the moment. I think he wasn't confused when he tried to take me into this hotel room 3 times. The confusion was probably a little, you know, persistent, but maybe now he's not going to be confused anymore. Yeah, he's going to have time to clear his head. And of course, yeah, there is the LA case, so let's see what we can do.
Carrie Goldberg is the attorney for Lucia Evans, the woman whose charges against Weinstein had been dropped by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office prior to his trial. Goldberg said Los Angeles prosecutors have contacted her in regards to the California case against Weinstein, but Evans hasn't yet decided if she's going to participate. She said the New York defense team was slippery and slimy during the trial.
It means a lot, but it's still pretty heartbreaking, as you can imagine, to have shouldered so much of this case for months at a time and to have spent dozens and dozens of hours being scrutinized by cops and the DAs and having to walk the crime scene, and then to just unceremoniously have the DA just decide that your case is dropped.
As for Weinstein's defense, Donna Rotunno called the sentence obscene and said there are murderers who will get out of prison faster than Harvey Weinstein will. She said the number of years he was given speaks to the pressure from the public and from the movements, not to the evidence or to justice.
We hope that this sentence will speak to the appellate court in a way that will show that this has been unfair from the very beginning. And here's just one more thing that we can add to the list from the ruling on the Molyneux witnesses. I think the way that the jury was selected, the fact that we asked to question people individually, discovery violations, Sandoval, juror number 11, extreme sentences, so we can go on and on. There was a Sandoval ruling in this case that the judge had made. It was closed to the public. And in that ruling, the judge was going to allow a lot of things in that didn't have anything to do with sexual assault, but just who Harvey is as a person. And we believe that those things would have been so detrimental that his testimony could have then been a problem. So we had to weigh that out. So as much as I think he would have loved to tell his story, in many ways he was barred from doing so by that ruling.
Rotunno went on to describe how Harvey Weinstein was reacting to the verdict and to the testimony, saying Weinstein is overall confused.
Harvey, I think, is very confused. I think he feels very sad. I think he believed he had relationships with women that were different than the way they are now characterizing them. And if you look at their conversations via email, it would be realistic to believe that. If you looked at the way Jessica spoke about him on recorded conversations with other people, it would be realistic to believe that. If you look at Jessica's testimony when she said, yes, I was manipulative of him. Yes, I made him think these things. How did he know? That's the question. So I think he sits there very confused. It's very easy to say all these horrible things about him. But I think if you look at the circumstances in real time and you say, wait a minute, what was really going on? It's easy to come in here now and make a show and come with your lawyers and run to Good Morning America. It's easy to do that. We don't know what happened in those rooms. But what we do know is all of the circumstances that surrounded it. And I will never be able to reconcile that all of those circumstances that surrounded it are what normal, regular rape victims do.
Prosecutors in Los Angeles said they have begun the process of extraditing Weinstein to California to face sexual assault charges there. As of this recording, no arraignment date has yet been set. In the meantime, he'll be processed into the New York Department of Corrections. And that's all for this series. A special thank you to Jennifer Tintner and her colleagues at the Law and Crime Trial Network for these episodes on the Harvey Weinstein trial. The reporters and producers were there every day, recording every piece of testimony, which I'm so happy that they were then able to bring to you. You can follow Jennifer Tintner on Twitter, at Jennifer Tintner. And as always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you think Harvey Weinstein is guilty as charged? How would you have voted if you had been on the jury? What did you think of the prosecution's case, as well as the defense? Let me know by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. To hear these episodes ad-free, to get access to bonus Court Junkie episodes, and to learn how you can support this podcast, please go to CourtJunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.